Shrink Wrap Radio number 432, Human Systems Theory and Practice with Mark Horowitz.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is family therapist and organizational coach, Mark Horowitz, MA, who is also the author of the 2014 book, The Dance of We, The Mindful Use of Love and Power in Human Systems. For more information about Mark Horowitz's background, please consult our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Mark Horowitz, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David. It's a real honor to be here. You've got quite a list of people that you've interviewed. Very impressive what you're doing there.
Thank you. I feel honored just to have had the opportunity to talk to all of these people. And when I first got the idea of doing a podcast based on interviews, I had no idea or vision of the people that I would be talking to. I just thought I'd be talking to some people I knew, but it rapidly expanded, and I could have known you. It turns out we've traveled in some fairly similar circles.
I noticed that.
And so I'm really happy to have you on the show because I realize that while I've covered quite a bit of the psychological waterfront, there's been a gaping hole in as much as I have not really covered systems theory.
Uh-huh.
And I have to say that you do an excellent job in your new book, The Dance of We. And as I say, we have a lot in common. We both began our careers strongly influenced by humanistic psychology and Eastern spirituality. I'm about seven years older than you are, I think. But we were both shaped by some of the same prevailing countercultural influences, both inside and outside of psychology.
Mm-hmm.
And I especially appreciated your account of your experiences in the organization that you call PSI. What did that stand for? Psychotherapy?
I just gave it as a pseudonym.
Yeah. So we'll use that pseudonym.
Yeah.
And you describe your experiences in what was a psychologically and spiritually oriented consulting group and various difficulties that ensued. And evidently you learned a lot about what works well in systems and what doesn't work so well in systems in that context. And for me, your account really resonated because for 7 years, I was chair of the psychology department at Sonoma State University, and we were all people of good intentions, goodwill, sound psychological background and so on, and yet those meetings were so difficult, and I think you tap into a lot of the dynamics that we were probably suffering from as a very progressive psychology department. So you start your book off with an account of your account with PSI, which you say actually was kind of cult-like. So maybe you can kind of bring our listeners up to speed by kind of giving a, sort of the highlights of that.
Okay. There were three threads that made me become interested in systems, and that was one of the three, and I can talk about the other two later. But when I was in my late 20s and early 30s, I was in part of a psychological training institute that had really incredible people, very smart. We had doctors, we had teachers, we had nurses, we had psychologists. We created a training institute for the kind of psychology that we were doing. We had a public counseling service. We had programs for the public. And eventually we even created a graduate school, and over the period, a very relatively short time of 7 years, we became more and more cut off from the world, and more and more sort of ingrown and what would I say, obsessional about what we believed in.
Yeah, and you actually used the word cult.
Yeah,
cult-like, which strong language.
Yeah, and I used that because after I finally left the group and started trying to figure out what had happened to me, how could a group of such good people have gone so wrong? I started doing research, and I found some people that were talking about cults and brainwashing of Korean War soldiers.
And that's a topic I've always been interested in as well. So yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and around that time in the 70s, there were a lot of cults going on, so it was very much in the news, and it made me. And then I started looking at systems, and because you couldn't point to any one person in the group, including the leader, and say he caused this. We were all involved in it in a way. We all got taken in. We all created this together. And when I started reading about systems, it suddenly clicked to me that this is what happened. We had come together, and over time, we had created an incredible entity, a larger whole, you might say, which had the potential of very good things emerging. But over time, we became very dysfunctional. And that's what led me to start reading more and studying more about human systems and what makes them dysfunctional and what makes them what I call in the book life-affirming.
Yeah, and so maybe a good place for us to start here is with the title of your first chapter. We're going to kind of step through as much of the book as we can. And the chapter, the very first title is, "What is a system?" And so tell us about that. What is a system?
Well, you know, a system is usually defined as when a group of parts come together, form a relationship over time, where the whole that gets created, that something emerges, which is a whole, which is greater than just the sum of the individual parts. So, you know, if you hucked into a room and you saw a bunch of body parts lying on the table, you know, a liver, a spleen, a heart, an arm and a leg. It's a gruesome example, but even if you could imagine how they all went together, you wouldn't understand consciousness, or you wouldn't understand personality. How do those things come out of those parts? Something greater than the sum of the parts emerges. There are closed systems, which are like machines, like cars or computers. And there are open systems that live and grow and develop, like the ecosystem, or like our human body, or human organizations. So I chose to focus in the book on what happens when a group of individual people come together and form a we. What's the miracle of we, and what's the dance that we do together to create this larger entity that we become a part of?
Yeah, and you use the word emergence at one point, and is part of that idea that something emerges from the parts that can't necessarily be predicted from those parts. And what emerges could be functional, and the term you use, life-affirming, or it could be dysfunctional, or what you refer to as life-deadening. And you might not know that before you.
Exactly. If you're starting an organization, you can do a lot of things and set up a lot of rules and structures, because part of what makes systems dysfunctional is the structures and the rules that we follow, either the conscious rules or the unconscious rules. And that those are the harder ones to get to in a group of people. You can do a lot to try and create a life-affirming system. So you see a lot of the new internet startups and biotechnology companies going out of their way to create exciting, life-affirming systems. And yet sometimes, even with the best intentions, those systems can still be, I make a distinction in the book, where a human system can be functional in relation to its purpose. It could, like a school system, could educate kids. It could, you know, train them for a profession, etc. But in terms of the way it treats its people, the staff, the kids, it could be dysfunctional.
Yeah, you know, one of the other systems that comes to mind as I hear you talk about this are bands. You know,
yes, yes,
rock bands and so on, and. And usually they have kind of a short life, you know. They start out, they may start out and everybody's really excited and maybe they enjoy some initial success. But at some point, things begin to fall apart. And I remember when I was a young faculty member at Sonoma State, there was a local band called Shanti, which is a wonderful fusion of Indian music, East Indian music, and rock and roll. And I just loved that band. And I was so concerned, I tried to peddle myself to them as a consultant because I just knew that something like that was likely to happen. And they didn't go for my idea, and they also had an unfortunately short life.
Yeah, what's your example is a good one. And in fact, I talk about bands as a system where you look at the Beatles, for instance, where as they come together, this whole emerges that's greater than just John or greater than just Paul or Ringo and George. And what gets created is beautiful. And in a system, in a healthy system, the whole that emerges takes care of all the parts, and the parts take care of all the whole, of the whole. So usually when systems break down, either the whole doesn't give the parts space to grow and develop, so it's not taking care of them sufficiently, or the parts aren't taking care of the whole entity because they don't realize how much it is sustaining them. And the bands are a good example of that when they fall apart.
I want to back up just a moment to give a nod to the progenitor, I guess, of this basic set of ideas, which is, I think, is called general systems theory. And it emerged out of computing science, I believe, and cybernetics and so on. And the name Bertalanffy,
yeah,
that name certainly comes to mind. And so a set of fairly technical, abstract principles designed to really help us understand systems at all sorts of levels, computers, the universe in some ways, and everything in it. And the idea of systems within systems was certainly one idea from that that made a big lasting imprint on my sense of what happens with systems.
Yes.
As well as the idea that systems in general seek to sustain themselves.
Yes.
they resist change.
Right.
And that's not just true of human beings, but you know, organizations or systems within the body and so on.
Right.
So I thought, wow, that was a really important idea. So, but what you're talking about here are human systems and human
right.
systems theory. And so that's, so I just wanted our audience to be clear about that.
Yeah. And what makes that And why I chose that particularly is because we're all swimming, living in human systems. Mm-hmm. And so most of the all of the examples in my book are from the systems that we are living in. Our families, even a couple is a system. Our families, our organizations that we live, that we work for, the nonprofits, our churches, our religion as a whole, the economic system, the system of the United States that got, you know, that is created, all of those systems we're swimming in. And unless we understand the effect that they're having on us, they control us, but we don't realize it. We think we're operating out of our own volition, when in reality, we're just succumbing to the system forces that we're not aware are pressuring us.
Yeah, it's interesting that this conversation that we're having relates so strongly to a recent interview that I did with a Jungian, where we weren't talking about systems per se, but he was talking about a kind of social unconsciousness and a cultural unconsciousness, that there are assumptions that come along with, you know, with being an African American or being a Mexican American or being a white American, and of being an American American, you know.
Yes.
That there are all these unconscious assumptions that drive us. So clearly, there's a strong relationship that you're making here between the external systems that we swim in, as you say, but and how those are impacting our internal psychological systems, which can also be viewed in a systems context.
Right. And, you know, in the book, I talk about one of the chapters is specifically about system pressures, to try and give people an idea of what those system, of how to identify and notice what different system pressures are on you. And then another chapter, which is later on, is called Self and System. And that has to do with how your internal psychological systems affect the larger system that you're a part of, but also how the larger system that you're a part of affects those inner psychological dynamics, either for better or for worse. Because, as you were saying, you know, what happens is that as the whole gets created, as this whole emerges, it takes on a life of its own. And it creates its own personality. It becomes as if it's alive. It doesn't want to die. It resists change, as you said. That's the principle of homeostasis. It starts acting as if it's its own entity. It takes on a life of its own. And that's important to see how that happens, because then you have to ask yourself, who's running the show here? The entity which has taken on a life of its own, or me, or us, you know?
Yeah, yeah. You know, one of the examples that I've noted from time to time is that certain high schools will have a personality or a culture. Mm-hmm. Say they'll be known as a bad school.
Yeah.
And it doesn't seem to matter, you know, generations of students will pass through that, so that the parts are changing, but it continues to have the characteristics of being a bad school, unless there's some major intervention.
Yeah.
That comes in to change that.
Yes. And you look at that in our own country, you know, the United States has a personality and it's different than the French, for instance. And we change our presidents every 4 or 8 years. And, you know, the overall personality of the United States changes very little over time. Mm-hmm.
I guess we should give a nod to Virginia Satir, and family systems therapy.
Yes.
I don't know if she's the absolute beginning of that or not, but certainly she's the outstanding person who comes to mind. And that seems to be the major place where systems thinking has come into psychotherapeutic thinking. And then I suppose the other place would be organizational development psychology.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And Virginia Satir, I reference her and I draw, I have a diagram of an exercise she used to do where she would have a family of five or so people, and she would tie their wrists together with various lengths of rope to indicate the strength of their connection or their distance from each other. So yeah. Some people had short ropes or some people had long ropes attaching them to each other. And what you know, computationally, a system of five people has, I think, something like 120 possible relationships of twos, threes, fours, and fives. And so what you see is that as one person moves, because they're tied together, it moves the whole entity, but it moves different people in different ways. And so it's a good demonstration about how we all affect each other and how cause and effect in a system becomes less relevant than what's happening and what are the rules and the structures that we're following.
Yeah, and one of the things that, one of the key ideas that we got from Virginia Satir's approach is the notion of the identified patient. Mm-hmm. In other words,
yes.
Little Johnny or little Susie or the errant husband, you know, that person is the problem. And if they would only straighten up and fly right, then everything would be fine. But the systems view revealed that that person is acting out a role that in some ways is compelled by the system.
And yes.
The whole system needs to change.
Yes. And I want to make it clear, because some of the early systems theory didn't make it as clear, is that oftentimes it was that little Sally was acting out something that she was being compelled to by the relationship of her parents. But the fact is that little Sally is part of that system, and so are her brothers and sisters and her parents, and often her parents' parents. So that's where there's systems within systems, as you mm-hmm. talked about. So to blame the mother or the father is really counterproductive and irrelevant. It's really to see what is happening, how is it happening, and then how do we change our relationships so that it doesn't happen? Not how do we point the finger at somebody and blame them for being the cause of our system problems.
Yeah.
You see that in corporations. I was a management consultant for a long time. And, you know, the quality goes down and the vice president of manufacturing gets pointed to and said, and they say, well, he's not a good leader because he can't control his quality control people and get them to do a good job. But everybody forgets that there are a lot of other dynamics going on in the system besides just manufacturing that are impacting that manufacturing system.
Yeah, I remember reading that example, and I thought it was a really good one. We said we were going to step through the chapters, and we've sort of been doing that. Chapter 2 is titled, Who's Running the Show?
Right.
And Systems Have a Life of Their Own. And in there, you talk about homeostasis and resistance to change.
Right.
And I guess we've been touching on who's running the show, and the answer is, the system is running the show.
If we're unconscious, then uh-huh. the system is running the show.
Uh-huh.
If we're not aware of how it's impacting us, then it begins to run the show. and create our behavior through the pressures that it exerts on us.
Yeah, now speaking of pressures, chapter 3 is titled System Forces, What They Are and What They Do. Right. And one of the things you talk about that I found fascinating, and I think I was exposed to it somewhere else earlier in my life, is the theories of Barry Oshry. Am I saying
yes.
his name
yes.
properly? And the discussion about tops, middles, and bottoms.
Yes.
Maybe you can take us through that.
He was he lives here in Boston. He's a mentor of mine. He's worked all his life to try and demonstrate to people the tangible and palpable system pressures that people feel in a hierarchy. In a system, the pressures on the tops in the organization, the leaders, are a different kind of pressure than those on the people who are the middle managers or the workers at the bottom of the organization. And unless you understand those pressures, it's very hard to work with those different levels. So, for instance, he talks about the system pressures that are automatic for somebody who's a top or a leader in the system is one of complexity and responsibility. You feel responsible for the whole system, and the whole system is very, very complex, and you're supposed to know everything about it. And that's either whether you're the CEO or you're the parent in a family, or you're the sergeant that's leading your platoon. And he talks about that these system pressures change as we move from one system to another. So I might be the CEO and be the top in my work, but I come home and my wife is fighting with my kids about something that happened during the day, and suddenly I'm caught in the middle between my wife and my kids, and I'm in the middle.
Interesting, yeah.
And I go to work the next day, and the president of the board of directors calls me and tells me what he thinks I'm not doing right, and all of a sudden I'm a bottom in relation to my board of directors.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, one of the places where I've seen this at work is having been a faculty member.
Mm-hmm.
And so there you've got the university president who is a top. He's not the top. He's not the guy who's run the whole system for the chancellor for the state of California. But of our local system, he's the top. As a faculty person, I guess I would be considered probably a middle, and the students may be bottoms.
Right.
Or the janitors and some of the staff, although they're real paradoxes and a lot of those things. But there was a large contingent of the faculty that was always pretty critical of the president.
Yes.
And what I realized, and I was sort of caught up in that, but I realized at the same time that the president has a different set of priorities than the faculty do. And the president has to have an eye on relationships with the community, relationships with the bosses above him, and the mandate that they've given him to raise money and do things that will elevate the prestige of the university and so on. And he's not really concerned as much about some of the things that the faculty are concerned about, which is the quality of instruction and making sure that all the mechanics of the instructional setup work.
Well, he may be just as concerned about that, but he's also concerned with those other things that you've mentioned. So how does he keep all of those things on his plate?
Yeah.
At the same time, even if he is concerned about the education in the same way that the faculty is. So what happens is he or she is under all these pressures to perform all these responsibilities, all these obligations, all this complexity. And then a faculty member comes to him and or her and says, hey, how about if we do this? This will improve the education. And how that shows up in the top's world is one more thing that the top has to deal with, you know, in their world of complexity and responsibility. It adds to the top's pressure. So unless you understand, once you understand what the life in the world of tops is like, you can come to that world in a different way that doesn't add to the top's pressure and can actually get your needs met in a better way. That's why I'm saying it's important to understand the pressures of the system.
Yeah, it comes down to our ability to empathize.
Yes, but not empathize. It is a kind of empathy, not to emphasize with the individual as a person, but with the world that they are operating in, which puts that pressure on them.
Yes.
What's an amazing experience is when Barry Oshry does his organization workshop, after you've played out this simulation game with half of the group as tops, no, a portion of the group is tops, a portion is middles, and a portion is bottoms, he changes roles. And all of a sudden, the bottoms become tops, and the tops become bottoms. And so you put different people in that role, and they start behaving exactly in the same way as the people that they had just been complaining about 5 minutes before. They suddenly take on all the responsibility for the organization, all their swimming in the complexity. They take on all that pressure. And the people who were the tops, who were feeling all that responsibility, when they become bottoms, they sit back and they go, phew, now I don't have to have that responsibility. Yeah. How come they're not paying attention to me up there, you know, in the top office?
This is also bringing to mind Zimbardo's Stanford prison experiment.
Yeah, yeah.
Where just being cast in a certain role, like the students who were told, okay, you are the wardens or the jailers, and the other students, okay, you're the prisoners.
Yes.
And it dramatically affected how they saw themselves, how they behaved, et cetera.
Yeah.
So it's another kind of example of the power of the system and of the assumptions that are the unconscious assumptions that are built into a system.
Right. It's assumptions, but it's also the rules of the system and the structures of the system that create that. Mm-hmm. And partly what I'm trying to do in why I believe that being able to see and understand systems is so important is because as you begin to feel that, then you have some choice. You have more choice in how you're going to behave. And the feeling of those system pressures is tangible. An example that I talk about is that happened when I went off to college and came home. This is probably true for a lot of people. You know, in my family, we all sat at the same place at the dinner table.
Yeah.
It was, we never agreed to that. No, we didn't have names on the chairs or anything like that. But I came home from college and I happened to sit in what was, quote, my father's chair.
Yeah.
When my mom called us to dinner and everybody comes to the table and stands there. And they're all looking at me, and nobody is sitting down. And we're all kind of nervously laughing because we don't quite understand what's going on. But I'm feeling the pressure to get up and to move to my seat. Yeah. And as soon as I get the pressure to move up, as soon as I get up and move to my seat, everybody sits down, and we all sort of laugh. And what was going on there was that we were following an unconscious rule that we had assigned seats. And the rule was we had to sit in our assigned seats. And unless we were aware of that rule, and it was controlling our behavior in that moment because we weren't aware of it.
Well, I resemble that. In our family, we do have assigned seats. But we're aware of it and I'm sort of like a dog, you know. He's got his place, his chair, his seat, his bowl.
Right. So I have some awareness of that. What I would suggest is one night, just for fun,
yeah,
shift seats and see how it feels. Because what happens is you actually get a different perspective. I'm speaking metaphorically, but also at the dinner table. You get a different perspective of the family and the system because you're literally sitting in a different seat.
Yeah, interesting. Well, in chapter 3 and 4, you talk about choice and power, and you talk about hierarchies. So tell us a bit about hierarchies, and you talk about power over, and I think power with.
The full title of the book, just before we, is The Dance of We, The Mindful Use of Love and Power in Human Systems. And what I, because we probably aren't going to get through every chapter here, but
no.
What I point out is that in dysfunctional systems, there are certain characteristics of dysfunctional systems. And 4 of them that I mention are that they objectify us, they separate us, they stifle the flow of information and creativity among us, and they demand allegiance from us as the highest source of values. So in order to counteract those dysfunctional characteristics, we need to exercise love and power and a balance of them in a way that we're not often used to. So most of the time, what we're aware of is, as power, for instance, is power over. And most human systems are set up hierarchically, whether it's at the police department or a family or the army or the government, because in certain situations, when you're fighting a fire, a hierarchical setup is the best way to do it. You want the people at the top to know what to do, tell people what to do, distribute to people, and get the job done. You don't want to vote on what's the best way to put out the fire. So that hierarchical system tends to generate a kind of power, which is power over. And almost all systems that get set up are hierarchical and therefore are prone to that top-down hierarchical approach, which I call power over.
Yes.
And the systems then get power over the people within the system.
Now, you mentioned objectification, and you've got a whole chapter on objectification and self-objectification. So
yes.
Tell us what you mean by those terms in this context of systems.
Yeah. I don't know if you, some of the younger people might not remember, but I'm sure you will. There's a scene from the old I Love Lucy, where Lucy and Ethel are in the chocolate factory on the assembly line. And the assembly line starts going faster, and they can't keep up with putting the chocolate in the little wrappers.
Okay.
So they start eating it, and they start putting it down their blouses and to keep up. And it's like they become a cog in the machine. Mm-hmm. They are an object. They're just another part of that conveyor belt. And it goes faster, and it's just hilarious to watch them. And they finally clean it all off, and the conveyor belt, and the supervisor comes in and sees that their mouths are full of chocolate, and the supervisor sees that the conveyor belt's empty, and she says, "Fantastic job! Speed it up back there!" And so, you know, and so yeah. they are just part of the machine. That's what I mean by objectification. But it's also what I mean by it is, for instance, when we see our children as extensions of us, we turn them into an object to be shaped and manipulated to, I don't necessarily mean that in the negative sense, to shape into the way that we think is best for them. And that's great. That's what parents should be doing. But on the other hand, if we lose sight of them as individuals who have their own desires, wishes, talents, and vision for who they are, then we turn them, we see them as less than they, than their fullness and uniqueness, and we turn them into an object. I could read a couple paragraphs if you wanted, or would you rather keep going? That would be great.
I would love to.
About objectification in families, for instance.
Yeah, go ahead.
What I'm talking about. So I'm quoting now. Many movies, novels, and autobiographies, such as The Great Santini or Billy Elliot, about the young boy who wanted from the mining town who wanted to dance, or the animated movie Ratatouille, have a common theme. A parent tries to live or relive their life through their children. The parent usually does this by pressuring the children to excel in areas where he fell short, or to be interested in things she wished she had pursued. This, of course, is understandable. You want the best for your children. You know the mistakes you made, and you don't want them to make the same ones. But it becomes dysfunctional when the parent stops seeing the child for who she is and perceives her primarily as someone who can provide an opportunity for a do-over in life. There are lots of stereotypes that fit this pattern. The stage mom, the dad who pushes his son or daughter too hard athletically, the professional who pushes his or her child to succeed academically, and so on. In each case, the parent doesn't really see what the child wants or is interested in. Rather, the child is seen as something to be shaped into a satisfying result for the parent. This is one form of objectification within the family. There is little recognition that the child is a person in his own right who may have desires, talents, and purposes of his own. Another version of objectification that many of us are familiar with in our families happens when children are labeled because of one strong characteristic. The child is then treated as if that one trait or skill or behavior is the whole of their being. Oh, she's the creative one. He's the schizophrenic. Our youngest is the shy one. While there is usually some truth in these statements, the problem comes when a mindset about the child is taken as the whole truth and family members stop seeing her as a unique, multifaceted being. So that's what objectification would look like. You know?
Yeah, so what about self-objectification?
So self-objectification is, I realized, is something that's really important that we very rarely talk about. So when we're in a system and we buy into and succumb to the system forces, we start treating ourselves as an object. We abuse ourselves by working longer hours than we know is right for ourselves. We go beyond what our job description is in order to prove how good we are to our boss. We turn ourselves into a cog in the machine. And we only see ourselves within that one defined role that we have at work. We don't realize that there are all these capabilities and characteristics and qualities that we have in the other areas of our lives that we could be bringing here to our work if we could step out of the mold or the objectification that we've created for ourselves. Another version of that would be the mother who self-objectifies her self in the role as mother. So she has to do all the laundry. She has to make the lunches for the kids. She has to be the one who assures that the kids are getting good grades and have their homework done and all of, and those kind of things. So in that, she's objectifying her. She's turning herself into only the role of the mother and leaving out all those other aspects of her life that she may be sacrificing in order to fulfill that role. That would be an example of self-objectification.
Okay. Now, one of the things that you talk about, I think, in terms of getting a system on the right track is values. You have a chapter called The Primacy of Values, Individual System and Spiritual. So tell us about that.
Well, as I said, that one of the one characteristic of a dysfunctional system is that it demands allegiance to the values of the system. It cuts you off or sees very little importance in other values that you might hold. So, for instance, in a business organization, you might be asked to do things that go, that are just over the line of your values. But the system is sort of demanding that you do this behavior, even though you're uncomfortable with it and you don't agree with it. You're pressured to, under the fear that you might be pushed out of the system if you don't. And you see that in a lot of companies where everybody knows what's going on, but it's very hard for anybody to blow the whistle. And usually those people who blow the whistle were speaking up for some higher values that were important to them than what the organization was exercising. But within the organization, you tend to get cut off from those values unless they're very, very strong in you. So that's what I mean by primacy of values. Which values are the most important? Because if they're systems within systems, which values are the most important to you? And for me, one of the whole reasons for study, for knowing about systems, is how can we be better expressions for the unique life energy that's flowing through us as an individual? And how can we be true to our own calling? And when is it not just a matter of my own internal fears or hang-ups or neuroses that are keeping me from expressing fully who I am? And when is it the systems that I'm living in that are actually keeping me from expressing my life energy?
And a theme that you hit on in relation to that has to do with seeing and being seen,
yeah.
which in a way reminds me of attachment theory and the importance of being mirrored, by the caregiver.
Absolutely.
Say more about seeing and being seen in terms of systems.
Well, it's exactly comes from attachment theory, and you could, all of us are craving being seen, no matter, to be seen for who we are as a unique human being and to be accepted in that way, just the way we are. Yeah, and no matter how good our caregivers were. And to me, to see another in that way is one of the strongest forms of love. And if the system separates us and drives us apart, then love and trying to see another person brings us closer together. So if we stop seeing another person as an object and start seeing them as a human being, we counteract that system pressure of separation. And what happens is in a, in a dysfunctional system where you're treated as an object, you're not seen. And that not being seen can exacerbate early childhood trauma of not being seen. So a system can either feed that early childhood lack by not seeing you, or a system can actually do a real life-affirming system can actually help heal that wound, early childhood wound, by acknowledging who you are and what you bring to the table, and by really fully seeing you. That's a real life-affirming system.
Now, I'm thinking back to the cult-like organization that you talk about in the beginning of the book. And what do you understand now about how that got off the tracks, given that everybody was very educated, very aware, presumably spiritually oriented, etc.? How did it get off the tracks, and how might it have been fixed?
Well, the one we fell into almost all of the four dysfunctions that I talk about. As we became more cult-like, we started to, number one, think that we had all the answers, that what we were teaching and believing was good, and what other people were believing and teaching was bad. And we even went so far, because we were a spiritual group, we thought that we were doing God's work, and we were doing service in the world, and that our service was what was in service of God. And so other people were not doing that, and they became, quote, evil. And so automatically we're separating from other people. And that came into the group as well. We started separating from each other. If anybody questioned what we within the group that were what we were doing, there would be a kind of shunning and a separation that would go on among us. And we thought we knew what the highest values were. And we demanded allegiance from all the members of the group to the values of the group. And we thought that those were life values. But in reality, they were just the values that the group was espousing. And it actually cut us off from real relationship, from real love, from the real expression of who we were. When I left the group, I was shocked and ashamed to see how much my worldview had been distorted by the pressures of that system, and that everything that I thought in the system was right, outside of the system, it looked totally crazy and bizarre and wrong, which people had been trying to tell us all along. But as soon as they would tell us that, we would brand them as evil and push them away and create more separation. And finally, the group imploded on itself. And once the people in the group, who are really fantastic people, left the group, over the years, we've all come back together as friends. And it took some healing and took some love and some speaking our power to do that. But it's very interesting to us as we talk about it that we're all back to being, most of us are back to being friends again, those of us who are in touch with each other. So it shows what the effect of that system was on us at that time in our lives.
Yeah, yeah. Now, one thing that I didn't mention is your book is divided into two major sections. The first is titled Human Systems and Their Dysfunctions, and we've heard a lot about that. Yeah. And the second part is titled Reclaiming Love, Power, and Self in Systems. So we're not going to have time to go through all of that, but I just want listeners to know that if they're wondering, well, what's the solution? I think there are a lot of suggestions about what the solution might be throughout the book, but particularly in that second half. And the end of the first half asks the question, and it might be a good one for us to kind of close on, is there hope? And particularly in relation, there was a quote from somebody, I don't know if it was at the beginning of the first chapter or at the beginning of that sort of prologue, but it was kind of a quote, and I don't remember who it was, but a very powerful quote of chapter two, and it's, "No one wants or works to generate hunger, poverty, pollution, or the elimination of the species. Very few people favor arms races or terrorism or alcoholism or inflation. Yet those results are consistently produced by the system as a whole, despite many policies and much effort directed against them." And that's a quote from Donella Meadows, author of Thinking in Systems. So my question to you is, given that kind of gloomy observation, is there hope?
Yes, I believe that there is. If the system is this, if the system emerges and the personality of the system emerges out of our relationships, then the way we change the system is by changing our relationships to each other. And that's where the hope is. When the system makes us forget that the other person is a human being and unique and worthy of respect and has value just because they're an expression of life, when it makes us forget that, then the hope is, where the hope comes from, is by changing our relationship and seeing them in that way as a unique expression of life, and seeing ourselves as a unique expression of life, and learning how to hold both of those as equal and simultaneously. So we change, one of the ways of changing systems, and where the hope is by changing our relationship to ourselves and to each other.
Okay, well, that actually could be a good wrap for our interview. But I'll just ask you, is there any other final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with?
The book has a lot of examples, and the real, for me, what the passion in the book is in part two, which we've spoken the least about, and the principles which would create life-affirming systems. And those principles, I think, are the principles of honoring life and the principles of respect and mutual value, and what I call the double golden rule. So I think that there's a lot in, as you say, in the second part of the book that describes how we could come to systems that would make a difference in those systems, the principles that we could bring, not just the techniques and the strategies, but what are the principles and the behind those techniques and strategies.
Okay, great. And I have to say, I found it a very thought-provoking and enriching book. So,
thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah,
I appreciate that.
Mark Horowitz, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David. I appreciate it very much.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Mark Horowitz. I was a lot more interactive in this interview than most. I think this was because Mark and I have so much overlap in our backgrounds, and also he was very easy to talk to. Consequently, I don't have much to add by way of commentary, because I think my comments during the interview effectively revealed my own thoughts and observations about the topic at hand. I guess one thing that does stand out to me after the interview is that the original theories relating to general systems theory were quite technical and almost like a branch of mathematics. As such, they didn't contain much human warmth, if any. Then, as general systems theory began to be adapted to the needs of organizational development and later family therapy, the systems approach definitely began to accommodate the fact that humans were involved. I think Mark has made a fairly unique contribution to systems thinking, inasmuch as he emphasizes qualities of empathy, mindfulness, choice, seeing and being seen, and love as key ingredients for keeping human systems on track to be life-affirming as opposed to life-deadening. I strongly agree with Mark that it would behoove us all to become more adept at systems thinking. In fact, his book offers lots of examples and exercises to help move us along on that course. This would be an excellent book for you to own or to give as a gift. Remember, you can use the Amazon.com widget in our right-hand sidebar to order Mark Horowitz's book, The Dance of We, The Mindful Use of Love and Power in Human Systems.
Al Tabor here. I've been a listener of Shrink Wrap Radio since, episode 20, and a regular contributor, actually, almost since then. I've been upping my contribution as circumstances allowed, and I think you should be a contributor, too. The reason I'm contributing is that I'm receiving something of great value. I always learn something, which is a prime consideration for me, and often something that changes how I view the world. What could be better than that? So we all need to chip in and keep Dr. Dave on the main line. In fact, I recently doubled down on my contribution, figuring that I would kick in a little towards folks that can't pay. Now, for you folks that know you should pay but haven't, and you know who you are, it's probably time to kick a little bit into the pot. So let's keep Dr. Dave broadcasting and keep the good stuff coming.
Thank you, Al Tabor. You know, Al is the one who asked me to create a special compilation of 6 interviews related to happiness and resilience in exchange for increasing his level of financial support for Shrink Wrap Radio. He'll send those interviews to selected friends on his holiday giving list. That's a deal I'll be happy to do with any of you out there. Just fire off an email letting me know which interviews you'd like to have in your own custom compilation. I'll cut out my commentary, announcements, and reading of emails, providing you with just the interviews themselves, and that'll make a great gift for your friends and also introduce them to Shrink Wrap Radio. I'm pleased to announce that we have a new transcript on the site thanks to listener Nick Dunbar, who has transcribed Shrink Wrap Radio number 394 on the benefits of playing video games with my guest, Dr. Isabella Gronick. And Nick is already working on another one. Thanks, Nick. Once again, let me announce our new continuing education course. It's titled Holistic and Nutritional Approaches to Treating Psychological Disorders for 5 CEUs. It's been a while since I put up a new course. It's available through the fully accredited Zur Institute. You can find a link to it on our website under the store tab. It's reasonably priced at less than $10 a unit. And by the way, you don't have to be a professional to purchase the course. Anyone can do so to beef up their resume or just for their own personal satisfaction. The Audible.com audiobook I'm listening to right now is another mystery by the noted Swedish author Arne Dahl. The title is To the Top of the Mountain. I've read/listened to almost all of his books on Audible. As a matter of fact, I think this title was just recently added to the Audible.com collection. I sure hope he continues to turn these out. I went onto Wikipedia and I found that his real name is Jan Arnold, And it says that he's a Swedish novelist and literary critic who uses the pen name Arne Dahl when writing crime fiction. And he's also a reporter for one of Sweden's leading newspapers. So if you'd like to listen along with me and you're not already an Audible.com subscriber, you can get this audiobook for free and to keep with no obligation to continue your subscription by going to audibletrial.com/shrink. And of course, you don't have to purchase To the Top of the Mountain by Arne Dahl. They have 165,000 other titles for you to choose from. Also, as I mentioned before, I've just signed up as an affiliate for the Apple iTunes Store. I think it's the case that you can use iTunes even if you're a Windows computer user. Actually, I know that's true. And at any rate, Shrink Wrap Radio will make a 7% commission on any music tracks or albums you purchase when you click on the little black and white iTunes banner in our left-hand sidebar that says Download in iTunes. That wasn't there before, I just put it up. I believe you can also use this to purchase other products in the iTunes store, such as iPhone apps and iBooks. This is so new that I really hope you can help me kick the tires by ordering something, even if it's just one song, and letting me know if it worked okay for you. For example, I'm not sure if it will work for folks outside the U.S. or not. So give it a try, if you'd be so kind, and let me know what happened for you. Finally, you know there is an Amazon widget in the right-hand sidebar on our site. But did you also know that you can use that to order not just books, but anything at Amazon? I know many of you probably use Amazon regularly to purchase all sorts of things. Plus, the season of giving is upon us, and many of you will probably purchase some of those gifts on Amazon. If you'll use the search tool in our widget, it will automatically add our affiliate code, and Shrink Wrap Radio will get a small percentage of the purchase. It's another way that you can help to support Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hi, this is Susie Gruber.
And Jerry Allen.
Somatic Experiencing Practitioners.
And you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Somatic Experiencing Practitioners Susie Gruber and Jerry Allen, whom I interviewed on Shrink Wrap Radio number 347. Now let's take a quick dip into the old email bag. And I'll read just one, and it's from Roger in the UK, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I really love the show and am very inspired by all the amazing people you interviewed. I work as a family therapist in the National Health System, I think it's National Health Services in the UK, and have a deep interest in the emerging field of eco-psychology. Hoping to do an audio for you, and will play around with my phone to see what I can produce. Just wondering if you might want to interview Robert Sardello, friend and colleague of the late James Hillman. Just reading his book, Love and the Soul, that combines ideas from depth psychology, Rudolf Steiner, philosophy, and eco-psychology. Pretty far out. But some of the best I've read for a long time. Someone who really knows his stuff. Check him out. The other person you might want to interview is Robert Romanchin, who explored the depth psychology of grief and also research that includes the imaginal world. His books include Soul in Grief and The Wounded Researcher, both excellent. Best wishes and thanks for all the amazing work, Roger." Well, Roger, it's great to hear from you. Thanks for your two guest suggestions. I'll add them to my long and growing list of listener-suggested guests. Robert Sardello certainly rings a bell with me. I'm not sure, but I think he may have visited our psychology department at Sonoma State University many years ago. By the way, I'm still waiting for that audio from you. Hint, hint. So I think with that, we'll wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember that in addition to emails, you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail on our phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to today's guest, Mark Horowitz, for sharing from his book, The Dance of We, and his insights into human systems theory. My next guest will be Dr. Van Jones, an expert practitioner of the psychotherapeutic approach known as transactional analysis. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.